Welcome. The last day of Denko Seishin, the last chapter of Keizan Zenji's record of transmitting the light. Sometimes hard to listen to. Maybe just difficult to understand. Maybe we feel like, what's this have to do with me? Maybe we feel like, is someone trying to pull one over on us? So I much appreciate Dogen's vow that we just chanted. We vow to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith. We vow that no doubt will arise in us, as doubt might arise in us. Or I would propose another way we could say it is, may we hear the true Dharma in such a way that if doubt arises, the doubt can't touch it. May we realize the true Dharma that cannot be shaken by doubt. That would be my understanding of the true Dharma, is that doubt doesn't disturb it. It's a hard one.
It might disturb us.
It might disturb us. Yeah, it doesn't disturb it. So may our faith and trust in the true Dharma be strong enough that doubt can't touch it. Of course, this is a tricky issue, because we could then be like, it might not be the true Dharma, right? It might be like, well, I know what it is, and like, you know, well, somebody says, excuse me, what about, I don't care about that, that doesn't shake it. In fact, this very topic, actually, I think, comes up in this story today. The 52nd ancestor was priest Eihei Ejo, also known as Koun Ejo. Ejo was the second abbot of Eihei-ji, so they take on the name of the temple when they abide there. Koun is a solitary cloud, and Ejo is strong or stout heart. Ejo studied with priest Dogen. Once, while asking for instruction, he heard the expression, a single hair pierces many holes, and was awakened. We vow that no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith. This one, maybe personally, I feel like it's hard to get a hair through this hole. But we'll come back to it when Keizan comes back to it later in the story. A single hair pierces or goes through many holes. And was awakened, and it doesn't appear in this Denko Roku, but in a later biography of Ejo by Gepa, it mentions that he heard this phrase about a single hair pierces many holes and was contemplating it. It's working with it as a koan, you know. And when he was setting out his orioki bowls during sesshin at lunch, that's when he awakened to the meaning of one hair pierces many holes. So we can be ready for awakening at any time. Don't think, well, now we're done with zazen and we just like, let's have lunch and just get those bowls out so ready for the food. The putting out the bowls. Now we set out Buddha Tathagata's eating bowls. May all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. Maybe it's when he was reciting that ancient verse that they recited in these times. That evening, Ajo made his bows to Dogen and asked, irrespective of the single hair, what about the many holes? Dogen smiled and said, completely pierced. Ajo bowed in prostration. So one thing I really appreciate about this book myself is that there's these stories, these koans that are the heart pointing out some practice principle, and then there's just the you know, day-to-day circumstances of these ancestors' lives and stories about them. And I think it's a nice mix because they have a really different flavor. One's like, what is this subtle instruction? And one is like, here's some things that they did, but these things that they did are like teaching stories, right? They're very moving to me. Ajo's initiatory name was Ajo. His family name was Fujiwara. He was the grandson of Hidemichi, a fourth generation descendant of the imperial minister of state Fujiwara Tanemichi. They love the genealogy. He joined Eino Hoin's community on Mount Hiei and had his head shaved when he was 17. So he was ordained as a Tendai monk, like Dogen. And many of the early Zen ancestors, maybe not, I shouldn't say many. After I think a few generations, it was just straight up Zen. But remember, this is when Zen has only been around in the country for a few years, actually. So when Ajo was ordained, maybe Dogen was just starting to teach. Not many people knew about Zen. So he was on Mount Hiei, the Tendai headquarters, and studied the Abhidharma and the Satya Siddhi treatises. This is another foundational vehicle treatise. Later he studied the Moho Jirgwan, or the Maha Shamatha Vipassana of Juri, a Tendai text. Realizing that there was no value in studying for the sake of fame and profit, he privately aroused bodhicitta. However, for a while he obeyed the will of his teacher and continued on through study of these written teachings. There might be value in studying them for the realization and practice of Dharma, but for the sake of fame and profit, like would be a famous lecturer or something, is not the reason. Once Ajo was at his mother's house and she commanded him, my intention in letting you leave home, to be a monk was not that you would be appointed to high rank and associate with important people. Don't practice for the sake of your gain and reputation, which, as we heard in earlier days, was kind of what was happening in this Tendai Buddhism in Japan of Dogen's time, is the monasteries were very wealthy, the monks were fighting, it was all tied into the politics of the state and imperial support and all of this. Maybe people were ordained just to actually have a like comfortable, wealthy life. Kind of the opposite of what you might think. Instead, become a black-robed recluse with your rain hat hung over your back, just going about on foot. When Ejo heard this from his mom, he consented, he changed his robes, and did not return to Mount Hiei. He studied Pure Land, the Jodo teachings, and heard the profound teaching of the founder of the Seizan branch of Pure Land Buddhism, Saint Shoku Kosaka. Later he went to see Saint Buchi Kakuan of Tonomine, who had received the ancestral style from Zen teacher Fo Zhao Duguang in China, and taught the meaning of seeing essential nature. Ejo surpassed the others in studying vigorously. So it sounds like I get the impression that the Pure Land school was not quite as corrupt as the Tendai school. Maybe they were a little more down to earth and lived a little more simply. And so when his mother said, this Tendai thing, get into all this like too much gain and fame going on, why don't you practice this simpler way? That's why I wanted you to leave home. So he practiced with these Pure Land, changed his robes to simple ones maybe, and practiced the Pure Land way. And then received this ancestral style, meaning like the Zen style, from Fo Chao, from Kakuan, who was a student of Dainichi Nonin, who is the founder of this Daruma Shu, the Bodhidharma school, briefly mentioned the other day, which was this new movement in Japan at this time of some Zen people who had some spontaneous awakenings and kind of set up a school, but without a lineage, just like sometimes happens in America in modern times, right? So, and they were pretty renegade style too. They took the non-duality thing as far as it would go, and so they said everything is empty and therefore it doesn't matter if you do this or that. And so they're like, you know, precepts, shmiseps, don't really matter, and practice even doesn't really matter. I think they maybe didn't even say zazen. And also they say this teacher from China. So it was one of these things, and I think you might find things like this in modern times as well, as Dogen mentions these stories, where it was kind of like people started pushing them about not having a lineage, Dainichi Nonin and the school. Like, you really can't just like make this up on your own, even if you have some understanding. You need some kind of living connection. So, well, there wasn't really a Zen lineage in Japan. I mean, it was just starting with Eisai and Dogen. And so Nonin, the founder of the school, sent one of his students to China with a poem he'd written, a clear poem, and said, this poem that shows my awakening, can you go like get some transmission papers from China for me and bring them back? Interesting, huh? So that happened. The student went and, you know, I don't know if there was some bribery involved or what, but so it was sort of like mail order transmission kind of thing.
Yeah, you get that sort of stuff on the internet, don't you?
Probably, yeah. I think, yeah. And Dogen would get all riled up about this kind of thing. He's through the Shobo Genzo. He's like, there's these people. So, in fact, when I read the record of Yunmen, who lived like several hundred years ago, I like awakened to the meaning of his teaching in a deep way. So therefore now I'm Yunmen's Dharma heir. I think Dogen brings this up in the face-to-face transmission fascicle, where he's like, no. A face must meet a living face. So the school struggled, I think, because of this. And but it was an active Zen school with several generations of transmissions at this time. And Eijo practiced in this school quite, like, you know, seriously. One time in a discussion of the Sharangama Sutra, they came to the simile of the pitcher, which is shaped like a Kalavinka bird. I don't know this part, I didn't look this up in the sutra, but the idea is, in the sutra there's this talk about a pitcher. And it said, when emptiness is added to the emptiness in the pitcher, the emptiness does not increase. And when the emptiness is taken out of the pitcher, the emptiness does not decrease. It's kind of a neat little story from the sutra. A little like commentary on emptiness that never increases or decreases. Yesterday's story, for those who were here, Kazan mentioned the bottom dropping out of the bucket. And he said, when the bottom drops out of your bucket, then no matter how much you pour into it, it's never full. And no matter how much you empty it out, it's never empty. I think the same principle as this. When the emptiness is taken out of the pitcher, it doesn't decrease. And when the emptiness is added to the emptiness in the pitcher, it doesn't increase. When Eijo heard this, he was deeply awakened. Saint Bucci, one of the Darumashu teachers, said, how can the roots of evil and the obstacles of greed, which have existed for countless eons, just melt away and all suffering come to an end at once like this? Amazing. More than 30 students there at the time thought that this was wonderful and they respected Eijo completely. Meanwhile, Eihei Dogen returned to Japan and Kenin-ji in 1227 to refine his practice. There was a rumor that he transmitted the true Dharma from China and privately wanted to spread it. Eijo got wind of this and thought, I already understand the Tendai teaching of the three types of shamatha and three types of vipassana, and have grasped the essential practices of the one gate of the Pure Land Buddhism. Moreover, I studied at Tono Mine and grasped the essence of seeing my true nature, becoming a Buddha immediately, Kenjo Jobutsu, which is a phrase from Bodhidharma. It's kind of Zen founding phrase, is a separate transmission outside the scriptures, pointing directly to the human mind, seeing nature, becoming Buddha. What could Dogen have brought from China other than all that? That's a lot. I already got What more could there be? He visited Dogen in order to find out. During the several days when they first talked, they thought that they saw things the same way and discussed the inconceivable knowledge of seeing essential Buddha nature. Ajo was overjoyed, thinking that his understanding was the same as Dogen's and genuine, and he praised Dogen all the more. After several days passed of their Dharma discussions, Dogen revealed an extremely different understanding, or an unusual understanding. At that time, Ajo was surprised and was about to raise an argument, but he realized that there was something beyond his own truth and quite different. Therefore, when he again aroused a determination or aroused the mind of Bodhicitta to rely on Dogen and hear his teachings, Priest Dogen told him, "I transmit this teaching style of the ancestors and intend to be the first to spread it in Japan. Though I could stay in this monastery at Keninji, I want to find another place and stay there. If I can find some place and build a hermitage or a grass hut, you should come there and see me. It's not good for you to be my student here." Ajo obeyed Dogen's decree and waited for the right time. In other words, Dogen's is one of the practitioners at this Keninji monastery that's with Rinzai Zen practice place, and I don't know who was the abbot there at that time, because Myo Zen, who had been, remember Dogen went to China with Myo Zen, who was the abbot of Keninji. Myo Zen died in China while they were over there. Which is kind of dramatic. I think in those days, maybe it was easier to die. Things were, you know, modern medicine wasn't around. I don't remember what he died of. And Dogen brought his ashes back to Keninji, so there must have been some other teacher when he returned, and he was practicing this community. So it's very, I think he's trying to be appropriate and say, if you want to, you know, practice with me, and this, we have a little bit of a different style here. It's going to cause a disturbance. So I'm waiting for conditions to find a place where we can practice this a little bit different style. You can meet me there later, which happens. And so this is the part I was thinking of when earlier I said this question about we don't want to let, may we realize the true Dharma that doubt doesn't touch it. And so it's a tricky issue because like Ajo was, you know, in accord. Yeah, everything Dogen says, sounds like we're in agreement. We're just checking it all out. And especially how great, because Dogen has this great reputation, and I'd like to be in accord with what other people also see as the true Dharma. And then Dogen started talking differently, and Ajo was like, "What is he? He's about to leave, right?" He was about to raise an argument anyway. I think some versions of the story are like, he actually is about to leave or even does leave. I'm like, no, this is too weird. And then later he comes back and he's like, well, maybe there's something more. So if he had said, well, I'm not going to let my doubt, that Dogen's arousing some doubt in my true Dharma, I'm not going to let that touch it, then he would have just gone on with his old way. So it's kind of open. He was open to doubt, actually, in this case. So there's a healthy opening to a new way. And I think early on when I met my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, I was quite drawn to practice with him. And when I think of that now, maybe one of the reasons is because I really didn't understand what he was talking about at all. There were other teachers that were like coming through teaching at Zen Center where I was like, yeah, that resonates with my understanding. It kind of confirms my current understanding. Great. But that wasn't so interesting. I'm like, yeah, I've heard it before. And still nice to kind of keep remembering and hear it from a little bit different angles. But with Tenzin Roshi, I felt like, what? And like, I need to spend more time with this person because I want to learn. There's something here, it seems like, to me. And I want to learn it. So, it was the very fact that I didn't understand that drew me so close. And I think that's what happened here. Something like that. Ejo already knew a lot, but understood practice and realization quite clearly. But here's something new. And so that's the spirit of bodhicitta, you could say. We never stop. We never get to a fixed place. We're like, I got it all figured out now. I'm just like past my time. It's maybe there's more. This is also my one of my motivations for continuing the love of Dharma study. The hard part is the more you do it, then the less there is that's new. You know, but there's always, especially if you start branching into other traditions of Dharma and even non-Dharma, what is reality? What is this life? What is most important? It's infinite, right? There's no end to this. And even nowadays, this is how beautiful, how fortunate I feel that you don't even have to learn another language to do that. People at this recent Zen Teachers Conference, there's some old timers who started practicing in the late 60s even, and say, you know, when we first started practicing Zen, there were like 5 books or less on Zen in English, like period. And of course, we gobbled them up right away, and well, that's it. D.T. Suzuki, maybe Nyogen Senzaki, Alan Watts, and now, it's like you could never imbibe all of the Dharma in English in one lifetime. Yes?
Well, you can always reread.
And that too.
The same
book. Yeah.
Certain select books.
Yep.
One could read.
I think so.
Over.
Mm-hmm. Especially the true Dharma. It goes deeper each time. Yes, yeah. So it's definitely not a matter of more, but that would be the same thing, right? I read the same, it's not like I'm done, I understood that book, next. It's more like you come back to it like, maybe there's more in that very same book. With Dogen in particular, I think there's no end. Dogen's profundity is, each time I read one of the same old fascicles, there's more that I haven't seen before. Yes.
There is this, you know, deepening, but it's also just like, it's a meeting, right? As if you were, when the Dharma is presented in such a way, you just meet it every time, and it has to be. How could it not be fresh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like a face-to-face meeting. Mm.
So even if your understanding is not deeper, it's a meeting in the moment. Yeah, I think we could say like that. May it be like that. Yeah, meeting is a good word. You could say it's kind of confirming. It's mutual confirming us and the Dharma and us. And it's a meeting. And at the same time, like Ejo had all these great teachings already, you know, maybe you could say, well, I'll just keep meeting those again. But he was like, well, at the same time as we keep meeting those, let's also see if there's more.
Because he didn't know Dogen. See, this is what I'm kind of feeling about this, is, you know, it's not about the books, it's not about the practices, it's the living experience, and he had never met Dogen. So I'm imagining, as they're having these Dharma conversations, there's also the whole, you know, the resonance of the field of what these two beings are creating by studying together.
Yeah.
That is beyond record. I mean, that's outside of the scriptures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It can't be written down because mm-hmm. it's a living, alive thing.
Yeah.
So I was also struck by just their friendship.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. They had
it.
Oh, they had a very deep connection.
Yeah. Very
mm-hmm.
strong.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And worked together to bring the Dharma out. Shobo Genzo's Wee Monkey, the record of things heard, is the record of things heard by Ejo. So that's his like notes from informal talks that he compiled. And I recently read that someone said. That whole Zui Monkey in priest meeting, we're actually going through this record of informal talks or practice inspirations, and it's not poetic philosophy like the Shobo Genzo. It's very just straightforward inspiration. And some scholar, somebody said that record of that Zui Monkey is very much influenced by Ejo and his relationship with Dogen and his past practice in this Daruma Shu. It's like there were probably many more talks than were recorded there, but the ones that he found interesting and recorded are the ones that were kind of like struck him personally. So that's part of the thing, that it's together. And also Ejo edited the whole Shobo Genzo. And sometimes, you know, compiled it, wrote his own colophons sometimes, and so this literary work that Dogen was just like pouring forth, Edgar was really involved in that too, as his disciple. So then later, Dogen did leave Kaninji and built a hermitage near Gokuraku Monastery. Gokuraku means like paradise. So apparently this was like a pure land monastery. Pure land's like the Western paradise. And it says he built a hermitage, but another version of the story is it was this old abandoned building on the grounds of this pure land temple. They're like, yeah, it's just a storeroom. You can use it. Dogen, whoever you are. and he remained there alone. This is just south of Kyoto, so kind of on the outskirts of the city where he had been living. After 2 years passed without a single person visiting, so he's like, and Dogen was on this like solitary retreat for 2 years. Then Ejo arrived. Yeah, they'd already met, right? But they're waiting for the conditions. In the beginning of Bendo Wa, Dogen talks about this. He's like, I'm writing this treatise to kind of convey this new understanding of Dharma, and for those who are wandering around like me, and maybe they'll find this, but the conditions aren't yet ripe for this to flourish in Japan. Later, they were. This was 1234. So Dogen was 34, and by the way, Ejo is 2 years older than Dogen and lived much longer also. Dogen died at 53. Dogen was delighted and permitted Ejo to enter the room, the Dokusan room. They discussed the ancestral way day and night. After 3 years passed, the present case came up while Ejo was seeking instruction. That is, the case was a single mind moment, a single thought instant is 10,000 years. a single hair pierces many holes. Passing this test is up to you. Surpassing the crowd is up to you. Hearing this, Ejo was awakened. So, we have just have one. A lot. For one thing here, we hear Dogen is offering koans for students to work with, which is, you know, sometimes they say, well, koans Zen, in this kind of really like giving someone a koan to work with, is more of a Rinzai Zen thing. It's not exactly clear, and there's a lot of modern scholarship saying Dogen was totally involved in koan practice, and some say, no, he just kind of informally. And we know he talked about them all the time. And he's, you know, he's the 300 koans of Dogen is kind of like his own, I think his own kind of like workbook. He like brought together his favorite stories and just this collection of the stories. And then he used this to kind of create the Shobogenzo. It's also called it's called the Chinese Shobogenzo because it's written in Chinese instead of Japanese. So case 85 in here is Shishuang's single hair pierces innumerable holes. Strange because it's similar to that what we just heard there, but different. Shishuang, this is one of the old Chinese ancestors, was once asked by senior monk Guanming, when does a single hair pierce innumerable holes? Shishuang said, 10,000 years later. Guanmin said, what will happen 10,000 years later? And Shishuang said, it's you who will pass the examination and excel among people. Which was in this earlier quote from Keizan. Later, this same monk asked the same question to Zen teacher Hong Yin of Jingshan. When does a single hair pierce innumerable holes? And Jingshan said, you personally will have to shine your own sandals and harvest your own fruit. It's very strange. Case here.
It's always followed by the, you need to figure it out yourself. Is that actually part of it? Are we just trying to isolate the hole and the hair and getting confused, but actually we have to think about the...
We could hear it as the instruction to really work on this and get it yourself. We could even say, I can't explain it for you. You'll have to get this yourself. And when you do, you'll pass, and you'll surpass others because probably nobody gets this. And it might take you 10,000 years. I mean, that's one way to hear it, right? So this is, you know, in Dogen's version, when does a single hair pierce innumerable holes? Shishuang says 10,000 years later. It's this kind of like when thing. And this version of Keizan's, which I think looks like an accurate translation too, says, a single thought is 10,000 years. A single hair pierces many holes. Passing this test is up to you. Surpassing the crowd is up to you. So we also, Shishuang, who's the one who brought up this phrase about the single hair, is known also for saying he's the one who you might have heard founded the Dead Tree Hall. He called his zendo the Dead Tree Hall because everyone just sat there like dead tree stumps. So Shishuang seemed to emphasize this like totally dropping this like letting your mind cease and desist completely. It's kind of, sometimes he's even criticized for going too far that way, like where's the dragon howl in the dead tree, for example, which Dogen later talks about the dragon howl in the dead tree. But Shirshwan just was into dead trees, these old stumps sitting in the Zendo, just like nothing happening here. And he had these phrases like, one thought is 10,000 years, an unused incense burner in a deserted shrine in the mountains. These images of like total coolness and lifelessness. Shirshwang, that was his kind of his family style. But he also has that phrase, one thought, 10,000 years. And when I hear that, I feel like in this, you know, very cool, deep samadhi, it's kind of like, it's timeless, right? And it's called in Japanese, nen. A nen is like a moment, or a mind moment, is one meaning of it. So, nen, nen, ju, shin, ki, thought, taking refuge in Buddha. Nen, nen, ju, shin, ki, nen, nen, fu, ri, shin, is thought, not separate from mind. Thought is itself mind, something. Nen nen ju shin ki nen nen fu ri shin. Thought coming from mind, thought not separate from mind. Something like this is the Enne Juku Kanagyo. This nen. Footnote here even says this is the Japanese for the Sanskrit kshana, which is like this, defined as like a moment, like 1/400th of a second.
Something. And that's 10,000 years.
Yeah, so yeah, this one moment, flash of moment, is 10,000 years. So that, you know, we can have this feeling in zazen, maybe sometimes, of like, just like, blip, and this blip kind of just extends like endlessly. It's like a hammer striking emptiness before and after its exquisite peel permeates throughout space and time. 10,000 eons, 10,000 yojanas. Something, you know, it's a poetic description of zazen. We could at least say that. One thought is 10,000 years. That's in the kind of, that's in the time department. One hair pierces myriad holes is in the space department. One tiny hair pierces infinite holes. Pierces. So, like, and again, this is very strange, one of those strange Zen images, but could also, I can imagine the image of, like, this one tiny hair, that's this very flimsy hair, right? And we're trying to pierce holes through like cement or steel. It doesn't say that, but that makes it even more provocative, doesn't it? This one tiny hair is going to pierce millions of holes perforated through 3-foot thick steel, like a mosquito biting an iron bull. Or we could hear it as, one other translation that one person put it as is, one hole digs innumerable ditches. So in that image it sounds like this work, this like impossible work of digging these huge ditches with one hair, right? So and that image is maybe a little bit about this like impossible task that becomes possible in zazen. Just like one impossible task of making one thought last for 10,000 years is impossible, but in the realm where time and space are not fixed, maybe.
Remind me the source of this metaphor, what precedes it? than hearing the full?
Well, Kazen's version is just simply that. This saying is, one thought is 10,000 years, one hair pierces myriad holes. In this story, a monk asks Shishuang, who's the one who actually is known for saying one thought is 10,000 years, but the monk asks, when does a single hair pierce innumerable holes? So maybe he was also known for this phrase, one hair pierces myriad holes, and because he was known for that, a monk asked him, you always say that, teacher, when does that happen? And Shishuang said, 10,000 years later. So I think these two are related. One thought, 10,000 years, one hair, myriad holes.
The character Mon for 10,000?
Yeah.
That was the largest character for the largest number represented by a character.
I guess, yeah.
Wasn't that character used to mean innumerable?
Yeah. So this translation, Kaz Tanahashi actually translates it as innumerable holes. The 10,000 things means the innumerable things. Yeah. So sometimes I feel like Daido Lori Roshi's comments, this is his, he put together these, with Kaz Tanahashi, Daido Lori collected or translated these 300 koans of Dogen, and then wrote his own commentary in the classical style and his own verses. So he kind of, it's a modern American koan collection, but not like a modern kind of, we might say, down to earth commentary. He wrote it in the heavenly style of the ancients. So, but I thought this might be helpful. This maybe I got a little bit of a new take hearing him. Daido Roshi says, a single hair piercing innumerable holes is a formidable task requiring diligent effort and relentless perfection. So that's where at least that's where he's going with it, is this impossible, especially if you think of digging innumerable ditches with one hair. Raising bodhicitta, practice and realization, whether in sacred or secular realms, require the same single-minded dedication. The monk's question is, when is the goal reached? This impossible task, when is the goal reached? Shishuang says, 10,000 years later. What is his meaning? Now we have a kind of a secret and intimate meaning that's not in this case. We've heard it already, right? That 10,000 years is one mind moment. That makes this task seem maybe still formidable, but a different kind of formidable. So Daido says, what is this meaning 10,000 years later? If we were there, we might say, one mind moment. If you wish to appreciate Shishuang's teaching, you must first realize that the process and the goal are a single reality. And then you must understand that to attain one Dharma is to penetrate one Dharma, and to encounter one activity is to practice one activity. This is called one practice samadhi. In it, there's no past, present, or future. There is just this single moment that transcends all space and time. Yeah. Myriad holes immediately pierced, which was Dogen's response, right, to when Ajo had this awakening to one hair pierces myriad holes. Dogen smiled and said, completely pierced, all of them. He said that 10,000 years later. Ultimately, this is not the doing of self or other, but rather the myriad dharmas advancing and confirming the self. But say, what does Jingshan mean when he says, you personally will have to shine your sandals and harvest the fruit? I ask, what are you calling yourself?
Good.
Yeah, yeah. And something about this, it's being given to you is the kind of, is one perspective, and at the same time, you have to shine your shoes. You have to, like, pick your apples to eat. After Ajo received formal approval, he followed Dogen without leaving him for a single day. He was like a shadow following the form for 20 years. Although he was given many duties, he remained Dogen's attendant, the Jisha, assuming the position when other tasks were completed. I, Kazan, heard him say often. So, Kazan, this is the first ancestor in the book here that Kazan met personally. So, let's see. From my own curiosity here, Kazan went. Yeah, I'm trying to see when he lived, when he was born. There's some debate, but 1264 or 1268. It looks like the most common guess is 1268, and Ajo was born in 1198. So that means.
And when did he die?
Oh yeah. When did he die? Yeah, 1280. So what's 1280 minus 1268 is what?
Twelve.
So yeah, according to these calculations, Ajo died when Kazan was 12. But since Kazan started quite young, I forget when he said he was, you know, younger than 12. He maybe at least it looks like he didn't like intensively practice Zen with Ajo, but he. He knew him because this was all in the same area. He met him. I personally heard him say often, although Nyozen had many followers, Master Dogen alone studied thoroughly. Although Priest Dogen had many followers, I alone went as his attendant to his quarters. Therefore, although I heard what others did not, I did not miss anything they did here. So this is like, kind of like Ananda. You know the story of Ananda, the Shakyamuni Buddha's Jisha? I think the Buddha asked Ananda to be his attendant, and Ananda said, this is in one of the sutras of the Pali Canon, Ananda said, I'll only be your attendant on certain conditions. Kind of like, that's pretty bold to say to the Buddha. But the conditions are, this is my memory of this, is quite a nice teaching, I think. The conditions are that I don't get any special treatment as the attendant. You might think, one request would, that I get some special attention? That I don't get any, because that'll hinder my practice. And that I can attend all of your talks, hear all of your teachings. And there might have been one more, something. Or maybe something like when we're at someone's house or something and gifts are given to you and to me because I'm your attendant, that I don't get those gifts, I will share them with the Sangha. Maybe something like that. So, and that's Luckily that Ananda made this request, because then he heard every single teaching the Buddha ever gave and he remembered them. And that's the whole, all the sutras we have are, thus have I heard, Ananda said. After he finally inherited the wind of the school of the ancestors, Ajo was always highly regarded by Dogen, who had him carry out all the ceremonies at Aheji. When Ajo asked him why, Dogen said, "I will not live so long, but you will survive me. You must spread my way without fail. For that reason, I value you highly for the sake of the Dharma." In the proprieties of Dogen's quarters, Ajo was treated as if he were the teacher. Or they had this very close mutual friendship. In each of the four annual periods of the monastery, he was presented with congratulations. So there's this tradition of the four most important days in the old days. In the monastery where they would do special ceremonies, are opening the practice period, closing the practice period, the winter solstice, and New Year's Day. So here at Warm Jewel Temple, we do three out of four of these ceremonies. In the ancient way, similar to the ancient way, but we don't do winter solstice. Maybe we should. They're all kind of, we'd be all kind of clumped together in the winter. And there's times of congratulation. They're kind of like celebration times. So we have tea at the beginning of practice period. That's a kind of a abbreviated feeling of this kind of like everybody's greeting everybody and many, many tea ceremonies that have Zendo tea, opening and closing practice periods. In this way, Ajo was treated with courtesy and honor. Teacher and disciple became one. The light of their minds, eyes merged like water combined with water, or sky merged with sky, without the slightest discrepancy. Only Ajo knew Dogen's mind, no one else.
Did Ajo write anything about
himself? Yes. Yeah. Since you ask, now is the time. He was mostly like worked on Dogen's stuff and was so highly influenced by the one piece that he wrote himself that's come down to us is a wonderful practice instruction. One of my favorites that I think is like very apropos of this sesshin, because it's called Absorption in the Treasury of Light. So, and it's all about the light that this whole record's been celebrating. So it's in this Minding Mind. Koan Ejo's Komyo Zo Zamai. Komyo is, ko means light and yo means light. So like bright light. Komyo is also used for like kind of halos or auras. So brightness. So there's a chapter in the Shobo Genzo called Komyo, and about various stories about light. And in fact, that's how Dzogen begins his treatise. Komyo Zo. So Zo is storehouse, or like the Shobo Genzo, or Jizo is the earth store, Bodhisattva. Shobo Genzo is the true Dharma eye storehouse or treasury. It can also mean womb. So my teacher, when teaching this, called it absorption in the womb of light. What an image, huh? He says, there's a chapter in light on the Shobo Genzo. Ajo says, the reason for writing this essay now, in addition, is to just bring out the essential substance, the fact that the countenance of Buddha Dharma is absorption in the treasury of light. Absorption here is samadhi. Komyozo zamai. The light, the brightness treasury, samadhi. The so-called, this is the unobtrusive application of inconspicuous practice carried out by oneself and influencing others, proper to people who've studied Zen for a long time and have entered its inner sanctum. The so-called treasury of light is the root source of all Buddhas, the inherent being of all living beings, the total substance of all phenomena, the treasury of the great light of spiritual power of complete awareness. The three Buddha bodies, the four wisdoms, and all samadhis, numerous as atoms in every aspect of reality, all appear from within this light. And then, this is a long essay, so it's nice. You can read through. It's like lots of sutra references. The Avatamsaka Sutra talks a lot about light. And then lots of Chinese Zen stories about light. Like, each one of you has a light. But when you look for it, it's hazy and obscured. But the end here is the wonderful culmination. And I think it's a great Zazen instruction. I humbly say to those who truly seek the way, who have the same aspiration, do not cling to one device, or one method, or one state. Do not rely on intellectual understanding or brilliance. Do not carry around what you learn by sitting. Plunging body and mind into the great treasury of light without looking back, sit grandly under the eaves without seeking enlightenment, without trying to get rid of delusion, without aversion to the rising of thoughts, and yet without fondly continuing thoughts. Cast body and mind into the great womb of light and don't look back. This is the center of the instruction. Now it offers a little bit more practical, and I think we maybe can relate to this. Maybe more than hairs piercing myriads of holes. So, don't be averse to the arising of thoughts, but also don't indulge in continuing them either. If you do not continue thoughts, thoughts cannot arise by themselves. That's hard instruction, but I think it's in that we can contemplate that if we're involved in thinking during Zazen. How about I just don't continue then? We might argue with Ajo, I'm not continuing, but they are continuing themselves. Mm-hmm. So this is a provocative teaching too. If you do not continue thoughts, thoughts cannot arise by themselves. In other words, there's something about you here doing this, actually. Like an empty space, like a mass of fire, letting your breathing flow naturally out and in, sit decisively without getting involved in anything at all. Even if 84,000 random thoughts arise and disappear, as long as you don't get involved in them, but let them go, then each thought will become the light of spiritual power of wisdom. That's wonderful. Yeah. Teaching of Ajo, don't you think? If 84,000 random thoughts arise and disappear, which they seem to do, as long as you don't get involved in them, but simply let them go, then each thought will become the light of this spiritual wisdom. We've probably all heard many times the basic Zazen instruction of thoughts arise over and over. What do we practice? Let them go. Don't get involved in them. Don't serve them tea. Just say, thank you for visiting. You can go now. But we might not have heard that if we let them go and don't get involved in them, then each thought will become the light, we might say. It already is the light, but then it will be recognized and appreciated as the light. And it's not only while sitting. Every step when walking is the walk of light. Not engaging in subjective thinking, step after step, 24 hours a day, you are like someone completely dead, utterly without image of self or subjective thoughts. There is no view of self when thoroughly dropping off thought after thought, step after step. Nevertheless, the breath comes in and out. The essence of hearing and the essence of feeling without conscious knowledge or subjective discrimination are silently shining light in which body and mind are one suchness. Therefore, when called, there is an immediate response. So, it's not like you're really dead. It's just after he's saying, you're like someone completely dead, walking around like this without holding on to anything. Nevertheless, the breath is actually still coming in and out. And hearing and feeling are happening just without grasping, we could say. Or even conscious knowledge or subjective discrimination. Then the breath moving in and out is silent shining light. Hearing, feeling are silently shining light in which body and mind are one suchness. Therefore, if somebody says, hey you, we can respond. Unlike a truly dead person. We could call this the dragon howl in the dead tree. This is the light in which ordinary and holy, deluded and enlightened are one suchness. Even in the midst of activity, this light is not hindered by activity. The forests and flowers, the grasses and leaves, people and animals, great and small, long and short, square and round, all appear at once without depending on any particular thing, just spontaneously dropping. So the window is wide open, with no screens or barriers anywhere. All these things, everything manifests without depending on the discrimination of thoughts and attention. This is manifest proof that the light is not obstructed by activity. It is empty luminosity, spontaneously shining without exerting mental energy. It may even be that Keizan Zenji was influenced himself by this treatise of Eijo, because Keizan's constantly saying it's this clear brightness but totally empty. It's like you can't find a hair's tip of skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, and yet there's not nothing. There's radiant brightness. So here, Edo is saying, it is empty luminosity, or it is luminous emptiness, spontaneously shining without exerting mental energy or any effort. This is naturally so. This light has never had any place of abode. Even when Buddhas appear in the world, it does not appear in the world. Even though they enter nirvana, it does not enter nirvana. When you are born, the light is not born. When you die, the light is not extinguished. It's not more in Buddhas and not less in ordinary beings. It is not lost in confusion, nor awakened by enlightenment. It has no location, no appearance, no name. It is the totality of everything. It cannot be grasped, cannot be rejected, cannot be attained. While unattainable, it is in effect throughout the entire being. From the highest heaven above to the lowest hell below, it is thus completely clear, a wondrously inconceivable spiritual light. And I appreciate how he even goes so far as to say, when you realize enlightenment, or if, when Buddhas enter nirvana, this light doesn't enter nirvana. And when we're totally caught up in grasping delusion, and self and other are a million miles apart, the light doesn't care, and it's not diminished in the slightest. That's the kind of light that's being celebrated. If you accept this mystical message, you do not need to ask anyone else whether it's true or false. He says, yeah, no, it's not really like that. Someone could say, and he said, okay, you can say that. It will be like meeting your own parents in the middle of town. Do not petition some Zen teachers for a seal of approval, and do not be eager to be given a prediction and realize fruition. Unconcerned even with these things, why then worry about food, clothing, and shelter, or basic animal desires and emotional attachments? Everything is let go and equal in the light. This absorption in the treasury of light is from the very beginning the site at which all Buddhas realize the ocean of enlightenment. Therefore, it is sitting as Buddha and acting as Buddha, carried on in its utter simplicity. Those who are already practicing the Buddha Dharma should sit at rest only in the sitting of Buddha. Do not sit in the sitting of hell beings or hungry ghosts or animals or jealous gods or celestial beings or humans. Do not sit in the sitting of Shravakas or Pratyeka Buddhas. Sit in the sitting of Buddhas. Simply sitting in this way, don't waste time. This is called the awakening sight of the straightforward mind, absorption in the treasury of light of inconceivable liberation. And be careful about this. Edo closes by saying, this essay should not be shown to anyone except people who are in the school and have entered the room. Of course, it's published in a bookstore in America. My only concern is that there should be no false and biased views, whether in one's own practice or in teaching others.
Like the whole, during our talks through the session, we've been talking about dropping off body and mind, and I'm just wondering, sort of, forgive me if this question is academic, how it relates to people's experience in their daily life when they get absorbed in things like sportsmen talk about being in that mythical zone where...
The zone.
Yeah, where things just happen, and there's a quote from Charlie Parker who says, don't play the saxophone, let the saxophone play you. And I suppose we all have those experiences when, you know, I suppose it's just as if suddenly time just disappears, sort of thing. And I'm just wondering how that's related. I suppose one thing is probably the fact that we sort of grasp on those sorts of things. We don't like them to end. When someone calls you for dinner, you go, hang on, we haven't finished the book yet, or something like that. So I'm just wondering how, forgive me, as I said, if this is academic, but how it relates to the dropping off body of mind, the general phrase.
I think, as he's talking about here, well, at least dropping off body and mind, it's not limited to sitting in a particular posture in the Zendo, right? A complete absorption in what's happening so deeply that then we see what's happening is not really what's happening. And I think that is the case when the music is playing, the saxophone is playing Charlie Parker, and when the basketball players are moving without thinking, which are nice examples too of the body is essential. So in our practice, you could say that especially in sports, it's like dropping off body and mind. Like they're not, there's people who couldn't, you know, break some of these sports records. Maybe they say if they were not in the zone, and we hear things like that, right? They're like, we didn't think it was possible, but then they'll talk about it and they'll say, but actually, it wasn't even me. It was like the body was just, went beyond itself. And so, in our Zazen practice, that's why we do emphasize the posture and the relaxation of the body so that the body can go beyond itself. And so I think it does happen, and people appreciate it in these situations outside of like a explicitly spiritual context. And sometimes they appreciate it in a spiritual way, and they'll talk about it, and that actually that experience then affects their life, right? I think that maybe that would be a potential similarity or difference. It's a, that was just really cool. I was really in the zone there, and now let me go back to, you know, all my, like, my troubled life of, you know, difficulties. Some people might be like that, and some might say, well, I know this really, I have a new take on my life. I bring it back. Yes?
Are you saying you could recognize dropping off body mind?
Good question. Maybe in these cases, I think it's often like it's after the fact, right? It would be retrospectively looking back and saying, wow, when during that game, during that song, whoa, what happened there? You know, something went beyond. And I think that's part of the maddening, or the, but the self is very like, can get very frustrated. This guy's like, I want to be there for that. But in fact, somebody is there, but that somebody is like just that old fellow, or that old gal, the inconceivable and inconceiving one. But then afterwards, there's maybe the appreciation. Yeah?
I have the experience occasionally in playing the piano. And I'm fully aware at the time that that's what's happening. That I'm not making the music. The music is just coming into being in the moment.
Maybe you're aware.
I have more of the experience of being a member of the audience playing music. I know it has nothing to do with the subject of being.
Well, so maybe that's another way to say this too, is like, do you, well, how did Sally ask it? Do you recognize it? Or?
Yeah.
Sorry, we recognize. So we could say there could be an awareness of it, but it's not the recognition of it in a dualistic way of like, yeah, how about that? Like, it's not just my usual self saying, oh, this is really cool, I'm in the zone now. I mean, there's a fine line there, what we call that kind of awareness, right? We might even be able to have the thought of I might creep in, but it's very kind of flimsy thought of like, well, I don't know what that is anyway, because I'm just in it.
Yeah, I don't have any sense of I.
Okay, so there.
I don't have any sense of identification with
yeah.
who I think I am most of the time.
So we could say there's a knowing, but not a dualistic knowing. And like Hong Zhi, the great Zen poet ancestor, has this nice phrase of describing Zazen. In his poem of the acupuncture needle of Zazen, he says it's knowing without touching things. Maybe even meeting without objects. Particularly that phrase, I really appreciate. No, Zazen is a kind of knowing, but it's knowing without touching things, including itself. Not like, this is Zazen as an object apart from the self, is kind of, that's what he means by touching things. That's how, usually knowing, like I know this is a book, my knowing is touching the object, but there's a knowing that doesn't have an object. Doesn't touch objects. Well, we could say there's that kind of awareness.
So then is this experience that he's talking about, is that enlightenment? The dropping off of body and mind, not touching things, new self, timelessness.
Well, you could say that.
Why are you saying it like that? Yeah! Why are you saying it? What's the hesitation?
Enlightenment is just this, like a kind of a pack term. So, how about we call it like seeing nature? So enlightenment, right, is this English word that if we're talking about, I hesitate because it goes into like,
A thing.
Well, a thing, but also I'm thinking.
A range of meanings,
and I'm thinking of the Buddha's teachings, like in the sutras. There's like there's the path of seeing. There's like the initial moment, and even subsequent moments. A moment of complete absorption like that is a kind of it's an insight. It's we might call it, it's an awakening. But then if we use enlightenment to mean Bodhi, as the Buddha meant it, especially Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, like complete enlightenment, then that would mean it usually means in the classical teachings is like when that, what do we call it, experience, or that non-dual awareness is never wavers. It's like continuous day and night. And that would be the classic original definition of a Buddha. So Zen tradition tends to maybe not get into those kind of like stages. They say like one moment of Zazen is one moment of Buddha. That's a very creative Zazen being this kind of Zazen that we're talking about, is Buddha at that moment. And then we're back into like, of course the light never comes and goes, but we think that we're back into like, and you know, I don't like that, and then like, we forget about it. And so in the original teachings it'd be like, then you've entered the path of seeing, but then you have this path, it's called the path of cultivation, or path of familiarization, which tradition is like many, many lifetimes eons, actually, of integrating this insight into one's entire life, so that one never, like, forgets it, or forget the word, like, it's never the direct realization of it never wavers.
So I have a little issue with that, because you only have a moment to have enlightenment. So what is this never wavers? You mean that moment? Because that moment dies, and then you have the next moment.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to carry it over to all your moments, and then you're calling it like a state. Enlightenment is like a state, then.
Well, what would you call it, the way we're talking about it? Maybe state's not such a good word.
See, I don't know. Like, my experience is that enlightenment comes and goes, and it doesn't, that you have those moments that he was talking about.
Yeah, those moments.
It clearly is something special. I don't know if I would call it enlightenment.
Yeah, so if we're saying...
It comes down, and then it comes back.
That's how it is, yeah. And then, but then, you know, classically for a Buddha, that experience or that realm, or it's dangerous to call it something, right? But that doesn't come and go anymore, right? So that's the classic thing. And even in Zen, you find some things like this. Although Dogen tries to avoid that, because then it sounds like it becomes a dualistic thing. This is it and this is not it. Even though the light, as we just heard, the light doesn't come and go when the Buddha has realized nirvana and people have experiences and don't. The light doesn't come and go. So that's helping us, guide us towards the not coming and going part. Yes.
If one mind moment is 10,000,
yeah,
to me it totally takes this beyond thinking about our lifetime and, you know, going from here to there or building Buddhahood. One mind moment is 10,000 years, is an incalculable amount of time, and, you know, to try to kind of fit it in our time frame and lifetime.
Yeah, well, that's a more like a kind of a more non-dual perspective and a kind of a Zen perspective. And I think Dogen's often coming from that place. It's like, don't think about the next moment. Just enter here now. This is it. So in a way, you could say this story of stages to Buddhahood is for people that live in the conventional world where there seems to be time and space. And then it's the world where we seem to suffer. I think this is all this fancy talk. It's all about relieving suffering. So you could say there's times when we can say, in my description of my experience now, even though in the back of my mind I kind of know all this, that the light's always here, I'm really suffering right now. And I'm not able to help anybody either, and I'm just caught up in my self-clinging habits. And you could say, if we recognize the light at that time, then because that is it. But then what about the time we don't recognize the light at all, and I don't have any faith in it at this moment? You could say, I think to call that Buddha is maybe going too far.
Why would you call that Buddha? Well, this is enlightened.
Would you call it, you're an enlightened person at the time that you're having this?
No, that's not what I'm saying, you're an enlightened person. I'm just kind of seeing it as when mind and object merge. I was looking at the Jujutsu-samai because it seems like what Rick and Sally are talking about is when mind and object.
Yeah, it's a moment of, we could use the word enlightenment. I just hesitated because...
This enlightened being,
or enlightenment even, in this classic definition is when it's unwavering, right? Or when if you achieve continuity, go beyond enlightenment.
When mind and object.
Yeah. When mind and object merge, yeah, this goes beyond enlightenment, because enlightenment is just our concept, right? As opposed to delusion. So all of these, everything is not an issue anymore. So in a way it is.
You're engaging in Buddha. It's like you extend the Buddha's activity.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a moment of Buddha activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think in general, you know, in Zen, when they talk about like Satori and Kensho and these words that often get translated as enlightenment in Zen, I think are referring to this experience, actually. And then part of this hesitation thing is that's even brought up with the ancestors is because this big term called enlightenment, it's like what the Buddha realized under the Bodhi tree, you know, is a little bit different according to the sutra version. It's the same exact realization, actually, but it's at that time for that person, it never regressed, or you know, his habits were like he went through the path of familiarization, they say, because of like his practice as a bodhisattva. It's one story. Many lifetimes of practicing as a bodhisattva, he was ready to do this thing that takes most people a long time, all in one moment. Most people, it's like there's the realization, and it changes us forever. Right? To appreciate that way of being, and I think this we do have these times in our practice and out of practice, and it does change our life. And then it's like, how much are we going to let it keep informing our life? And for the Buddha, it was maybe like all the habits were like and instantly like dropped off at his moment of enlightenment. So for most of it, it's like we still have all this habit energy that's not integrated into this realization. Then we go back into it, and it's like the habits aren't there when we're in it. That's the beauty, right? It's like all my ancient twisted karma is actually not here for this time, but then the twisted karma like has you know, that the causality of the twisted karma pulls us out of it, and we're like, and you gotta do this and then wow. And then we're like, then we gotta go back and forth. Which is kind of a dualistic way of looking at it, which is why Dogen tries to undermine that thing of like, well, there's this, and then you're out of it, and you're in it, and you're out of it, and you're in it. That very thought of being out of it and in it actually is part of the delusion that's part of the habitual thing. It's quite subtle, because then I think just that the danger, it seems like it's happened from the earliest days of Zen, is that people then say, they have this experience, and they're like, that's enlightenment, I'm done. That's what they're all talking about. So now I guess everything I do must be like enlightened activity. Which sounds kind of funny, but I think this has happened in ancient times and present times. We hear about it, this, right?
Is it maybe the most enlightened thing is just, being willing to suffer, but really suffer, and not, I don't know.
But really suffer.
Really suffer.
Without resisting
really
it.
Really suffer, yeah. Like, really feel it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think we really, those of us in the room here, follow the story of progression and that kind of progressive Buddhahood or enlightenment. We just come and sit down.
Well, maybe one way to talk about the progression in a way that doesn't seem like it's so special is just like sit down with a deep intention to completely drop off in this moment and then come do it again. So we do that, yeah. So it's kind of like that's kind of training, that's the gradual kind of training thing. And we do notice a difference, don't we? Like, we do it more and more, and it's like, it's easier, maybe a little bit. Of course, it's slower than we'd like. It's easier to tap into it again. We don't go quite as far and maybe as deeply into the suffering as we used to. And you could say that this is this gradual path of progression.
It's even while you kind of remember the teachings not to grasp onto things, not to try to get anything out of practice, you also feel like, yeah.
Bodhicitta. Yeah, bodhicitta, the aspiration to keep going until whether there's an end or not, like to extend this this wonderfully free possibility through what appears to be time and what appears to be space and our meetings with other people and our daily activities and all of that, right? So yeah, maybe it's just a old traditional way of talking about these stages, but maybe that just like the fact that we're doing this, practicing completely in the moment, and then we also have like a schedule, and we come on different days, and we do over time and over years, and like, so in a way, it's kind of like that. There's the moment, and then there's the time progression, and something does deepen. So we read the descriptions of those stages, they sound kind of like maybe too awesome, or there's too, sounds too much, but one of the classic stories that I've heard about those bodhisattva stages is when the bodhisattvas are on those stages, they don't see them as state. They're like, I'm on the third bodhisattva bhumi now. They don't see it that way, actually. They're just practicing and just continuing to practice. But for those of us like that are like have these conceptual minds that are into like numbers and stages and at least some of this, my conceptual mind is into that stuff. Then I'm like, oh, here's a nice picture, a nice chart of how it looks. But that's all. It's not really, yeah. Like ultimately, there actually aren't any stages.
He said, like, we don't slot. The enlightenment experience, and I think he goes on to talk about practice and enlightenment. It seems like if you had to summarize it, we don't slight the enlightenment experience, but we just keep on making the mundane profound. That's the sort of understanding I see it sort of in that.
And how do you make the mundane profound?
By practicing, I suppose, just being there. That's my interpretation anyway.
Yeah, which is a little bit like this saying, what about when suffering could just suffer? That sounds a lot like what Edgeo says when he's like, you know, let go of the 84,000 thoughts and sufferings arise, right? But don't try to get rid of them. Remember he said that? Don't try... without trying to get rid of illusion, without aversion to the arising of thoughts, yet also without, like, this is fondly continuing, sometimes we do, but I think maybe means like, you know, indulging them, like, I just gotta finish this thought, and then I'll stop. But this leads to another one, oh, but that's a good one. Or this one, I have to work out this issue before the Zazen period ends. What a great time to do it. No one's bothering me from this issue. I get into that sometimes. Nice concentrated time to like think. But when we catch ourselves, then it's like, no, that's we can try. Let's just let it, gently let it go. And And then, so I think really letting the thought be the thought, really letting the suffering be the suffering, no aversion to it at all, then completely in it, which is quite hard with suffering, right? So hard. It's like that's the one thing we want to like change or get rid of. Right? It's completely, I mean, settled so into it that then we start to see, well, what is this suffering? We talked about that the other day, like physical pain, right? Like settle so deeply into the painful sensation that like we start not being able to get a hold of what it is, or an emotional feeling is interesting to explore too. Settle completely into it and like so present with it without telling all the stories, well, it's because of this and that, and like, I shouldn't feel this way, and no, I just do feel this way, and what is it? It's a psychophysical event, but I'm having less and less ability to get a hold of it or name it. Yeah? And then, like I say, at that time that we can't quite, we don't really, really know what the suffering is anymore, you can say the light, it becomes a light, or its light is revealed.
There's a line from Gandhi, which I can't say that I practice or practice very well, but it's a line he said, suffering carried cheerfully ceases to become suffering and is transformed into a source of ineffable joy. As I said, I don't practice that very well, but it really struck me and puzzled me.
Carried cheerfully?
Yeah.
So we might say even more like, that's maybe already a little too extra. How about just suffering just carried as it is? Because maybe it could be that cheerfully means like, I should be more cheerful with my suffering. Come on. Smile. But actually, maybe that then we're kind of like trying to make ourselves something else. So, with all due respect to Gandhi, I might edit his advice.
If you believe that suffering comes from God, and you're obviously very in touch with God, you can carry it cheerfully, I suppose. But I'm probably not that good a relationship with God.
Well, so yeah, maybe we could say, if you see that your suffering is a manifestation of all the causes and conditions in the universe coming together right now to create this suffering, it's like huge vastness of the totality of everything is like converging on this point of this body and mind suffering. In a way, that's maybe like, that's how I might think of like, God's given me the suffering. And then, if we're kind of open to that way of it, then maybe there's some cheer, or at least deeper peace within. It's like, okay, it can't be any other way than it is right here and now. And then, it's maybe not the same suffering as it was. Like, if it's Gandhi's cheerfully carried suffering, is that suffering? Yeah, yes and no. Right? It's not like we suddenly become just super cheerful, but it's also like, well, it's a different relationship to the suffering.
To me, that kind of fits in our context of our practice, it's more like, This is my ancient twisted karma, and may I meet it so that it can be released, kind of.
Nicely like, put.
That's how, to me, it could be.
Yeah. If we don't see that, we have to be careful with those words, that we don't say, this is my ancient twisted karma, like, I'm a bad person. We could hook that in, right, to the kind of like...
It's an opportunity just to be grateful that this is an opportunity to meet and release this to actually be in it and experience it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of like that all my ancient twisted karma, all my beginning is greed, hate, and delusion throughout, you know, beginninglessly. I fully avow means like I am like with it right here and now in this moment. It's all come to this. This is the result of all my ancient twisted karma, this moment. I think it's a nice way to look at it. That's what one definition of the experience of any moment, joyful, painful, enlightened, deluded. I could say any experience of a moment is the culmination of all our ancient twisted karma, good and bad and neutral and seen and unseen. And so, therefore, may I receive that fully, because there's no other there's no other culmination of twisted karma other than this one right now. There can never be any other than this one right now. Yeah, that's a nice way to look at, like, well, I really like this enlightenment thing. These stories sound great, but, like, my experience is not like that now. If we say, like, but my experience is like this right now, and it's not really even like my experience, it's like made by everything, then actually the light is starting, that's already there in our suffering, is starting to shine through.
I think it's kind of a strange experience of thinking about the mind-only teachings and like this 3D, like the mind is spewing this whole material world. But then the light is there, and the light was kind of having this image of like all this messy stuff kind of getting vacuumed out as it's getting spewed forward and then vacuumed out, and there's just light. But it's too much for the mind to. It's endlessly fascinating, but to actually reconcile with reality, like. Really?
How about just...
What is this that we're living in?
Yeah, we don't know. And the more we don't know...
And then trying to have an image of light is also kind of...
Yeah.
...work very well.
Well, the nice thing about light, which you could say the whole thing is just a metaphor, right? Because various places, whenever light's brought up, it's often conjoined with, by the way, this light is not like... the light from the candle, or a light bulb, or a red or blue light, or even like the clear light of a flashlight. It's not that kind of light. So it's not like it's like the room is filled with light right now, right? But we don't see it. We just see the reflections as the light bounces off things. We see the light through the apparent objects that it reflects on. So in your creative visualization, which I like playing with these things too, like the mind is spewing out the zendo here. something like that. The mind, but and then the light is vacuuming up all the extra garbage and debris. And I would say it's not vacuuming up all like the appearances of the altar and all and the cushions and all of us, is vacuuming up the all our kind of like twisted, you know, grasping of all that stuff. So it's, you could say the light is vacuum, just like that's the dust. You could say the dust is like our grasping things as like they're really real, or they're really not real, or they're like this or like that, I'm like this and like that. It's vacuuming up all that. So just like when you vacuum the a rug, it doesn't actually look that different. You do all this work of vacuuming it up, all this dust is gone, but actually it appears pretty similar, but we're more satisfied. Now the zendo is like, okay. Even though, well, it looks pretty much the same. Maybe sometimes, I think Linda Ruth Cutts used to talk about sashin eyes. When you sit a while, actually your like visual consciousness is a little different, right? It's like things are actually brighter and like more vivid sometimes, you know? It's often clear. It's maybe just that we're more aware and we're just like, our everyday mind is just kind of like dulled and filtered, and now it's more just like, I never noticed that tree before. Actually, so I've walked by it every day and I'm, wow. And look at that. So we could say that that's the same old tree and the same old street and the same zendo, but it's been vacuumed by the light. You could say it still appears, but the vacuumed quality is like, you could say that's what made it look like, why I didn't even notice it, and it looked kind of like generic. It looked like a generic image of itself instead of like the direct true image, because the dust of my habitual thing of like, I've seen it, it's like my mind no longer even, I don't see it anymore because of the dust. I don't know if you have that experience when you come home from vacation, if you've been out of your house, is like the most familiar thing, right? And so I love this, happens like over and over. You have to be gone for a certain amount of time, and then you step back into your like the most familiar room, and it really looks like totally different. What? For about like 5 seconds, usually for me, it's like really short. It's like, this is not how I remembered it. Again, it's like everything is pretty much the same, but I think we get a vacuumed version. For 5 seconds, we get a vacuumed version because we haven't seen it for, it's fresh. And then it'll mean, oh yeah, I know, I've seen it before. It's the same old, same old. We dedicate any merit arising in this world today to all beings everywhere. May they fully receive the vacuum cleaners that are all around them and enjoy the vacuuming process. Beings are numberless. I vow to save. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.